And it's to the alcoholic who still suffers. I'm not a doctor or a psychiatrist, but I'm not frustrated by that fact. Because it is my happy privilege to see many people recover from a seemingly hopeless malady of the spirit, the soul, and the body. I am not an oracle. I don't fancy myself as such. But I've had a long time to look at and try to read the miracle of AA. And what I say is my own opinion. And I give each one of you the right to disagree with everything I say. I believe in every man's religion for him, and in no man's religion for me, but my very own. I told you last night a little about the start of my last drunk to date. It started the Friday before Christmas, 1945, and it ended up the middle of January sometime in 1946. And I want to tell you this morning about the middle of it and about some of the things that have happened since. Or the end of that drunk rub. Because with no reason known to me, I woke up sometime about the middle of January. I had nothing in my system but liquor. I hadn't eaten for I don't know when. And I had done nothing but empty bottles from the Friday before Christmas, the middle of January. And Mrs. C would tell you that when I took to the bed to drink, I emptied 2 1/3 quarts a day. It took 7 quarts of whiskey to keep me down for 3 days. And I had been doing this from the Friday before Christmas. And yet I woke up on this particular morning with the clearest head I've ever known. I had a little period of sanity. It might have been 15 or 20 minutes in duration. And during this time, for the first time in my adult life, I saw me without an excuse to world. There was nothing between me and me, and I saw me. And it was a rather miserable thing to look at. And I knew for the first time in my life that I had lost the battle of life. I didn't know why. I knew that I couldn't get out of this thing alone. I knew why my good wife, after 20 years, was divorcing me, and I knew she should have done it 10 years before. I knew why the kids wouldn't come home when I was around if they could help. I knew why my boss had sent word to the house that if I ever stepped foot in the plant again, he was going to throw me through the window. And the window to which he referred does not open. And I completely and totally accepted the fact that morning that everything dear to me in life was gone and that I was not entitled to have it back. And the last thing that went through my mind before the curtain came down, and I was drunk and sick and insane again. I remembered that I had read Jack Alexander's article in the Post in 1941 about fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I must be sober about it. I didn't want sobriety for myself. My life was over. But I must be sober until I died, and for one reason. I didn't want to die with the record. I didn't want the kids and those who were dear to me to remember me only as a tongue-chewing, babbling idiot drunk. At whatever time I had left, I knew I was going to die. I had come awful close to it the last time out. And I didn't care. But I must be sober that I died in order that I might rub out what I could of the record. And that was the only reason that I wanted to be sober. My life is over. And I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I will find AA. And down came the curtain. And I was very sick, and I had to die a lot of times before I started to get well. But from that moment until this, it has never been necessary for me to take another drink of liquor or a sedating or tranquilizing pill of any kind. Now, this is the reason that I lay so much stress on surrender. Because on this particular occasion, I sobered up with liquor in the house, and I knew where it was. The only time in the last 10 years of my drinking that this ever happened to me. Well, there was quite a little period when I didn't think that I was going to make it. I'd had many occasions where my mind would go and come like turning a light on and off, but this time it went and it didn't come. And I said to myself, this time the cord's broken. I'm never going to get it back. It's gone. I'm just going to remain in pain. But finally, it did. And I got well enough to start looking for AA, and I had no thought of looking in the telephone directory or anything like that. I thought the thing was anonymous. Never occurred to me to be listed, so we had to call people and ask them if they knew anybody that knew anybody in AA. We finally got a number, and I called a guy. And he was a picture man. And he was working nights. And he said, they had a drink. And I said, no. And he said, don't take one. Maybe tomorrow I can take you to meeting. And tomorrow I called him, and he was still working nights, and he couldn't take me in the next day. And I said to him, Kent, I don't need you to take me to the meeting. Where is one that I can attend? And he gave me an address. And it was a Sunday, just like this. And it was in the Veterans Foreign Wars Hall in Beverly Hills. And when the time came, I went. And I got there before the meeting started. And there were about half as many people as are here. And they were all yapping, you know. Nobody listening, everybody brrr, you know. And I stood at the doorway, and I listened, and I looked. And I said to myself, this is the wrong night. They've given me the wrong dope. Because you didn't look like me, and you didn't talk like me, and you weren't dressed like me. And I said to myself, these are the veterans and their wives, and they're here for a party. And I'm going to have to leave and come back the night of juncture here. And my heart was in my shoes. And I turned to leave. A man came up to me. He'd been watching me. And he says, mister, were you looking for somebody? I said, no. Well, he says, what were you looking for? And thinking that he was a veteran, I said, well, sir, if it would interest you, I was looking for sobriety. And the whole being of this guy changed. He lit up like a church. And I was hooked before he ever opened his mouth again. Here was a man, a stranger, a total stranger to me, who was glad that I was there. when the people that knew me wouldn't even talk to me. And he was glad. And I knew he was glad. Because he lit up. And he said to me the most wonderful words that anybody will ever say to me. Why, he says, take off your hat and coat. You're in the right place. And they shared their experience, strength, and hope with me, strength. And I decided that night that I wanted what you had. And I became willing to go to any length to get it. But I left that meeting with a great fear upon me. Because I didn't think I had enough left to get it. I almost came too late. I had no body or no mind. But I wanted this thing more than life, and so I was in a meeting every night. With this great fear on me. Became an eavesdropper. I didn't want to bother anybody. I didn't think I had any right. And so I'd see two people talking, seemingly doing a pretty good job talking about this program, and I'd back up and stick my ear to the conversation. And if they caught me, I'd take off and pick up somebody else. And if they included me, I'd have to go out under the pepper trees and cry. I couldn't believe that people had that much interest or cared that much. And I'd go cry a while, and then I'd eavesdrop a while. And this went on for 6 months. And I woke up to the fact that I was sober. And had been all the time. And it was the first great awakening of my life. Now from that time till this, my life has been nothing but a series of awakenings. A series of discoveries. And the resultant discarding that has to take place when you make a discovery that is contrary to the conditioning that you've had preceding. And this has been going on for 17 years. And it's been a remarkably wonderful experience. Now, this is what we want to talk about a little bit this morning. I am convinced, as that I stand here, that there's only one problem in life. One problem that includes all problems. All fear, all frustration, all dis-ease, all disease, and all insecurity are caused by one thing. And there is only one answer that includes all answers, be we alcoholic or not. Because there's not one answer for me, an alcoholic, and another for you, a non-alcoholic. As I see it, there is only one answer. That includes all answers. Now, the problem is the feeling of conscious separation from life, good, God. These are synonymous terms to me. The feeling of conscious separation from, the thing that tells me I'm different from and other than you. Here am I, big me, little me, fat me, lean me, smart me, dumb me, here am I, against the whole world. And I have to outthink, outperform, and outmaneuver in order to eke out a miserable living out of an unfriendly universe. Consciously separated from. Now I believe this to be the best definition of the human ego you and I will ever hear. This is, to me, the human ego. The thing that separates us, one from another, and from the living God that made us. And I think this is the only roadblock there is. This is the problem that includes all problems. Now, the answer is the feeling of conscious unity with living in a part of the conscious awareness of the fact that in Him we live and move and have our being. This is the answer, the one answer and the only answer. There is the last. And herein lies the great importance of surrender. This feeling of conscious separation from has to be done away with. It has to go by the board. And it goes in surrender. The roadblock is then gone. And we wake up to the fact that we are a part of and not a part from. For instance, that happy chatter that I heard the first meeting I attended, this just floored me. But I was a part from it. And I couldn't understand. I even thought it wasn't my people, you see, the drunk. And I was apart from and as alone as any man ever walked. There is nothing or nobody quite so alone as an alcoholic who's run out of time. And now that happy chatter I'm a part of. And I can come into a meeting to try it again or to walk. And sit in the corner and close my eyes and listen to it a minute and go through the roof. The apart from and the part of. This has to happen to each and every one of us. And when it does, it's the difference between hell and heaven. I sat in the same chair, in the same living room, with the same wife and the same kids. For 10 years in hell and 11 years in heaven. Now this don't sound right, does it? Something's got to change. The chair or the woman. Same chair, same living room, same wife and same kids. For 10 years in hell and 11 years in heaven. Then we moved to Laguna Beach, and my children fit the coloring in the living room. They put it back in the bin. And it took me 5 years to get it back out in the living room. But I got her again, and I was sitting right in the same one after 17 years. Now, how could this be? How could this be? Some years ago, I talked to St. Louis, Missouri, at the annual banquet. And our beloved Father Ed Dowling was there. I'd heard Father Ed, and he'd heard me, and I loved him, and I think he loved me. And so after the thing was over, Mr. C. says to me, "Let's ask Father Ed to have coffee with us." And I just think it'd be a fine idea if he'd do it. And speaking of alcoholic, I said, "You asked him." And she asked him, and he accepted. And we sat down the booth, and he started asking questions. And he wouldn't quit. And I said to him, "Father, I've talked all evening. You talk. Let me listen." So he'd ask another question. And the last one he asked was about the family. And I said, "Well, Mrs. C. with us, let's let her answer." And so she answered. And Father Ed sat there as well as he'd want, with his little mouth pursed up, looking off into space for seemingly 10 minutes. And he finally turned around and he says, "You know something, Chuck?" And I says, "What, Father?" And he says, sometimes I have to believe that heaven is just a new pair of glasses. Sometimes I have to believe that heaven is just a new pair of glasses. And I look to Mrs. C, and I says, honey, where is the difference? Because we don't happen to catch it. Where is the difference? Because that is exactly what this program has done for me. It has given me a new pair of glasses. I don't see as I used to see. I don't hear as I used to hear. I am not motivated as I formerly was motivated. My action pattern is not at all like my former action pattern. Everything has been made new by the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, by the grace of the living God that made it. Now, if there's anything that this program has shown me to the total and complete satisfaction of everything in me, spirit, soul, and body, it is that the first two words of the little prayer that we'll use directly to close our meeting are true. Our Father. Our Father. And if God is our Father, as I am most certainly convinced that He is, then we are His children. Now, He has always known this. But you and I, as individuals, have to find it out. We have to find it out. Now, many people say, if there was a loving God, how come He let you suffer in hell for 10 long years? And it is my conviction that He loved me enough to allow me to make my own mistakes, that I might the sooner run out of my own ability to live, run out of my own resources, that I might the sooner come back home and discover that I am a part of and not a part from. I love the New Testament account of creation. Because in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and without the Word was not anything made that was made. And the Word became flesh and dwelt amongst us. And God became people and dwelt amongst us. I am convinced that God lives through us, His children. And it is this discovery that makes it unnecessary for us to walk alone anymore. It's this discovery that takes us out of the separation into the unity. Now, I don't believe that this gift of ours, this gift that has returned us from the land of the living dead into the land of the living, I don't believe this is special dispensation or special grant. I don't think it's something that might be granted or withheld at the whim of a capricious God. I believe rather that it is something discovered, something uncovered. There was a chap lived in 1066. His name was Brother Lawrence. He wasn't even a priest. And in talking to one of his people one day, he said, if you would find God, look deeper than yourself, because it's the only place you're ever going to find him. And for the likes of you and me, if we're going to look deep within ourselves, we've got a little wreckage to clean up first. We've got some windows to wash. We've got some debris to get rid of. And this we do by the practice of these principles, the 12 steps of AA. The first 9 steps of the program, amongst other things, will bring us to the point of abandonment of self. Can't help it. There is the admission of defeat, the recognition of the need for help, the inventory and the cleanup of the amends. And in the surrender, we're temporarily without the ego. And without the ego, we don't need its children. And what are the children of the ego? Self-pity, resentment, judgment, lies, deceit. We peel these things off just like peeling a banana. In the practice of these principles in all of our affairs, in the doing of these things. And pretty soon we have removed the overburden. And we look deep within ourselves and find ourselves. And in finding ourselves, it includes our relationship one to another and our relationship to the living God that made us. How fortunate can we be? You know, there are people who choose this way of life. I suspect that Ed did that. Chose this way of life. But you and I somehow couldn't get it that way. We are here because of the accident of failure. We are here because doing it our way, we ran completely out of our own resources. And we didn't even come to find that which we have found. We came just looking for a way to keep from drinking, one day at a time. And the way to keep from drinking, of course, because of the very apparent fact that alcoholism is a total living problem. The answer to the disease of alcoholism has to be a total living answer. And of course, there is no total living answer until we come back home. Until we come back home to the living God that makes us. Oh, I'd like to go on and on and on. Because this thing to me, it's fantastic. I have seen not only the recovery of the mind and the spirit, but also of the body. In my own case, I got a new body. But I have seen such things as cancer and everything below it go out the window. Do nothing but the great physician and the prayers of his children for one they love. These things are convincing beyond any written words that we can find. And I love it, and I'd like to talk about it. And I'd also like to talk a little about the way I love you. Because, you see, I thought you were too stupid and too mean to merit my attention for many years. I wasn't interested in you. I was interested in God. And I went through the systems one after another because it was very necessary for me to be able to understand, pinpoint, and define the Almighty. But I had no interest and no love for his children. Even the good ones I didn't like, and the drunks I hated. But the great change, the new pair of glasses. Because now I'm not much interested in God. I mean by that in understanding and trying to define. I love him out of all proportions. But this came about through finding his children. And through coming to see that God is people. And coming to see God in people. And people have gotten so dear to me that I want to take a whole bunch of them on my lap and rock them to sleep. Particularly the drunk. Because even loving all people, I love the drunk the most. And I'd like to talk about that and the transition and how it came about. But I haven't got time. And I'm going to close by telling my story in the way that I have used many times and many of you have heard it. The little story of the prodigal son, which to me is my life on the way down and on the way back. This is my story. And so far as I'm concerned, I'm not even stealing from the book. And I tell it the way it seems to me. I give it my own meaning because it's my story. And it allows me then to understand me and to understand you and to know our relation to each other and to God. It goes like this. Certain wealthy man, God, had two sons, you and I. And the youngest one came to his dad and he said, Dad, give me my inheritance. I've got a lot of things to do. I've got big dreams. I'm going out to California. I'm going to cut me a big swath out there. Give me my inheritance. And my father didn't say, no, bud, you better stay home. You get out there away from home, consciously separated from. You get out there in the far country and you're liable to run into trouble. We got everything you need right here. We're wealthy. Stay home. No. He gave the kid no argument at all, but gave him his inheritance, and the kid went away from home. Into a far country. And wasted his substance on riotous living. And maybe he didn't do that, but that sounds just like me. And after he spent all the roads of mighty famine in the land, and as serious as this thing is, I put their butt out laughing every time I think of it. There arose a mighty famine in the land. If there's anybody that can understand the famine, it'll be us. How bad can a famine get? You wake up someplace, hot as a two-bit pistol, everybody looking for you. People trying to bank your checks with a tennis racket. I don't think they make famines like that no more. There was a mighty famine in the land, and the kid came to want. So what did he do? He did just like you did. did just like I did. He went to a man in that country. We went to the doctor, to the psychiatrist, to the hospital, to China. You know? He went to a man in that country, and of all things, the man put him to doing. Could have put him to doing, he didn't. He put him 10 in the case. Now, this is very significant. Because this was a Jew boy telling that story, and they don't like pigs. They just don't like pigs. And for a Jew to be tending pigs, there is nothing worse. And what he's telling us is that the boy, he was down. He had run out of his own resources, sure enough. And while he was in the pig pen, he got hungry. And he fain would eat the husk that the pigs did eat. I think I know about that pig pen. I spent a lot of time in it. And the next line is terrific. It says, and no man gave unto him. He was beyond human help. And no man gave unto him. Our book says, probably no human power could have relieved Diophilus. The same thing. And the next line is better than that one. Because it says the kid came to himself. Now, I remember that morning in January, 17 years ago last January, when I came to myself. And the kid saw just what I saw. He saw that he had failed in the business of living, that he had sinned against man and God, and that he wasn't entitled to anything at all. He lost the battle of life, but he remembered that in the Father's house was plenty to spare. That was the same self-condemnation as the alcoholic. He said, I can't go back home and ask him to put me on as his son. Look, here's your boy, take me back. Can't do it. I'm unworthy. I'm no good. But he remembered again that the servants had more than he did. Many servants now. And they lived pretty good. And so he says, I'll go back and ask him to take me on as a hired servant. And so he made a decision. He says, I will arise and go to my father. We made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God. The same thing. And so the kid starts home. And here then is the miracle of AA. Here is the miracle of AA. This is the thing that makes me believe. That's a great search can stop. Because the kid started home and the father saw him a long way off and came to meet him. Oh, this is true. And the father saw me a long way off and came to meet me. And the man said, take off your hat and coat. You're in the right place. And so the kid started trying to tell his father what a bad job he'd done, how he'd messed up his life. And again, the father didn't hear him. He didn't say, yeah, I know. I got the books on you here. I know every time you got in the house. I know every time you turned left when you should have turned right. I got the record, and you sure are a miserable character. Now get the grubbing hole and get back here on the back 40 and start in on those persimmon sprouts and saxifrage bushes. And if you do a good job, maybe 25 years from now, I'll invite you and we'll have lunch together. No, no. He didn't hear. He put a ring on his finger. The symbol of eternal life. No beginning and no end. He fell on his neck and kissed him. And he called the servant. And he said, kill the fatted calf. Let's have a corpse. The boy was lost. And he's come back home. That God could and would. If so. God bless you all. Thank you very much.